Hey, it's Scott.
And Jamie.
Thanks for listening to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. We've recorded this episode way back before we named the show and figured out what our deal is.
And we'll be back in the finale to let you know what's coming up next. Cheers.
Mazel. But no, the important thing that Robert Duvall says, and I feel like, Jamie, I've said some version of this to you in the past, which is, well, fuck me, and fuck him, and fuck you, and fuck the fucking horse you came in on, you fucking asshole. What a fucking asshole you are.
Yeah, you've definitely said that stream of profanities to me.
Well, it's true. Fuck you, you fucking asshole, and the fucking horse you rode in on.
And the fucking horse I rode in on. Yeah, you're right.
Hello. Hello, internet radio podcast people. My name is Scott. For many a moon, ending fairly recently, I used to run movie theaters and theater logistics and operations in Philadelphia. And then a dangerous, transmissible global pandemic came and knocked the shit out of my industry. And while I'm staying at home and being a dad and doing it safe, I'm also watching a whole bunch of movies.
And I'm Jamie. And similarly to Scotty Boy here, I lost my job at the beginning of the pandemic. And just so the listeners know, you can't see Scott's face, but when I said Scotty Boy, he got visibly upset. And I just wanted to note that for everyone.
Oh, it wasn't it what you said. It was just the tone of your voice that I find offensive. I don't have to listen to the content. I want to be clear.
All right, Scotty Boy, quiet down.
It's the timbre. It's my part. It's the timbre that's really offensive.
This is the part where I introduce myself. So I'm Jamie. And I've been in the wine community and restaurants in Philly for about a decade, but not for the last year. And now I drink wine and I like do social media things and also this podcast with this MOOC here.
And here we are. We basically know what we're talking about. Watch some movies that I will recommend. Jamie will recommend some wines that are delicious and available to go along with them. And then join us on our new adventure, which is where we try and see if those two things pair well together.
Yeah, it's been a blast so far.
I've had a good time. It is. It continues to be totally non-intuitive. But then every once in a while, something has clicked. And it just like, yeah, it just makes sense. So for today's episode, we reversed our normal formula where I select a movie and Jamie pairs a wine to it. Jamie had a wine selected already. So James, why don't you introduce the wine and then I'll say what I paired it to.
This is Domaine La Roche. It's a property in Chablis, which is in northern France. But this is their sort of base entry level Bourgogne Chardonnay. It's from the vintage 2017. And the words that I gave Scott some lead in here, like he normally does for me, three words that sort of describe the wine so that he could pair a movie to it. And I told him that this wine was steely, that it was rich, and that it was textured. And I believe it to be all three of those things. And Scott came up with...
Well, we watched the 2018 Steve McQueen thriller Widows, which was one of my favorite movies of that year. And we'll unpack this, but everything on paper said it should have been a huge hit and a major awards contender. And neither of those things happened and nobody really saw it. And I'm still baffled. And I want to have a box of Blu-ray copies of it that I just hand out to people wherever I go. So Widows, here we are. I've got my bully pulpit.
Yeah, I kind of think everybody should watch this movie.
Everyone should like Widows, right?
It's smart and thoughtful. And also it just like rules on a baseline level. Like it's engaging and it's exciting and it's... We're going to talk about this wine here first.
No. Let's skip the wine. Let's just talk about Widows today. Just 2 hours of Widows today. That's all we're talking about.
No, we're not going to talk about the wine at all. We're just going to pound a whole bottle to the head at 10 in the morning.
It's a half bottle for me, Jamie. I can't keep up with your professional alcoholism.
But the effect is the same. A half bottle on you, a full bottle on me.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
Anyway, so Chardonnay. Let's talk.
Chardonnay. Let me see if I'm familiar with the rep that Chardonnay has. That I may have even played into by selecting this movie, which is that Chardonnay is for like bored housewives.
That's your wife texted me that we should do this movie, knowing that it was going to be a Chardonnay, simply because it was a housewives joke. Not only is it the domain of middle-aged white women everywhere, but it's conceived to be sort of like this full-bodied, flabby, over-oaked, over-malolactic, malolactic fermentationed. I'm really doing great with the verbs today.
Malolactic fermentation. That's what you were going to say. Malolactic fermentation.
Malolactic fermented. Overly mallowed. I don't know how to say it's too much mallow, but people...
So it can be too mallowed? Too much mallow? Is this marshmallow?
It's funny that you say that, because one of the flavor aroma components of malolactic fermentation is sort of a marshmallowy kind of thing.
All right. Explain this term to me. Let's assume I know what fermentation is, which I probably don't, but I don't think people need to hear all of that. What is the mallow? What is the lactic?
So the fun thing about malolactic fermentation is, like, it's commonly called malolactic fermentation, but it's not actually a fermentation. It's a bacterial conversion.
Oh, that helps. Thanks. that really clears it all up real good there.
Malolactic conversion is the conversion of malic acid into lactic acid as carried out by a bacteria. It typically takes place after the alcoholic fermentation, although sometimes concurrently, depending on the wine. Almost all red wines go through malolactic, and it's just sort of a thing that, like, that's how red wine tastes. But white wines, only certain wines go through malo. The idea there is you're softening your acidity. Lactic acid is not as sharp as malic acid. And the flavor result is lactic acid gives you like a milky, cheesy, marshmallowy kind of aroma. When someone says, I want a rich, buttery Chardonnay, that butter component is a product of malolactic conversion.
And that's not even like a bit of colorful language, like, because it's lactic acid, so it has the dairy. I'm getting it, dairy. You used a word that I understand from food.
Yes.
Lactic acid, lactose, milk, cheese, cow product, buttery wine. This isn't like when Jamie's like, oh, this wine tastes like shoe leather and the overflowing ashtray from a 1978 Chrysler LeBaron. Like, you're not speaking metaphorically when you say butter.
Well, yeah. So lactic acid is part of it, but there's not really any acid present or much present in actual butter. There's a byproduct of malolactic conversion, a chemical called diacetyl, and that's the smell of butter.
Wait, it smells like butter?
Yeah. I think this wine smells like butter. It smells a little bit like Parmesan rind.
I get the Parmesan rind. You get a little bit of that funk, that funky Parm rind. A little bit of citrus, maybe? Some citrusy notes on the schnuffer?
Let's not jump the gun here. We're not talking about fruit components. We just talked about mallow, which is part of what people think is wrong with Chardonnay. If you've ever had Kendall Jackson Chardonnay.
Well, I've been to a wedding, so I think I've had that before. Yeah.
Exactly. That's sort of the popular conception of what all Chardonnay tastes like.
What is it about the Kendall Jackson that people hate that you say is not actually a problem?
I use Kendall Jackson because it's a good touchstone. I think it's good because it still tastes like fruit. There's still some amount of acidity to it. But a lot of people think of Chardonnay as sort of the caricature of that, which is something that is basically like drinking melted butter. Low acid, fatty, flabby. It's got the, like, way too much oak presence. So a lot of cinnamon, allspice, clove character. And it's all just turned up to 12. Yeah, bad Chardonnay is made, but it became so widely planted because it is just baseline a good grape. It's relatively easy to grow, which is one of the problems because it can grow in poor soils and make sort of innocuous wines. But when it's in a good place, it produces something like this. And this for $21, I think it's spectacular. It's got great acidity. I think it's up front. It gives you that sort of steely, mineral-driven effect that I look for from a Burgundy Chardonnay. Then it sort of opens up into this sort of richer, fuller-bodied kind of textural experience. There's a lot of fruit here. There's a lot of orchard fruits, pears, apples. I think you're right. There's a decent amount of citrus here as well. And no oak at all. This was totally stainless steel fermented and aged. And I think that this wine is super duper versatile too. It would be really great with food. I think poultry is the thing that first comes to mind, but like a meaty fish, a tuna, a sea bass, swordfish, something like that. This one would be great, but it's also really, really great by itself. It's not overly aggressive in any way. It's a good sipping wine.
Yeah, with some of the wines we've done previously, I felt like I was missing something. And then later on when you would say, well, this really should be paired with food and not, you know, a 2-hour audio visual experience. I was like, oh, maybe that's the thing that I thought it was missing out. But no, this one stands on its own very nicely, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, let's talk about the place that this wine comes from. The appellation that's noted on the label is Bourgogne. And that's French for Burgundy. Or Burgundy is English for Bourgogne, is really what it would be. Yeah.
Why can't we just call it what they call it? Bourgogne is not that hard to say.
I think that that's obnoxious.
It's also confusing because I always assumed that Burgundy only made red wines.
No. Burgundy makes red and white. Red is Pinot Noir.
Then why is their name red, Jamie? This is what I'm saying. I'm making your point for you.
Yes.
Is that it's stupid. Why do we have to anglicize everything?
You're making my point while also bothering me, which is...
And interrupting you, which is the most important part. That's the trifecta right there.
It truly is. All right. So... This wine is imported by a company called Wilson Daniels, and it's the same company that imports the Montefalco Rosso, the Arnaldo Capri that we did for I don't know why I'm blanking on what episode.
Was it Marriage Story?
Marriage Story. That's right. It was a terrible pair for Marriage Story, but it was a good wine.
I thought it worked out pretty well.
I mean,
I don't remember
drinking it. I think we came to the conclusion that it didn't work, that the pairing was not the best.
It's a good thing no one's holding us accountable to these pairings.
No.
I hope.
So shopping by importer is a thing. I get that it can be difficult, but it also can be helpful in finding things that align with your tastes. Importers typically have some sort of a unifying factor in what they bring into the U.S. If I go into a wine shop and I see a bottle with the Wilson Daniels stamp on the back, I can be pretty certain that this wine was made using modern techniques, by which I mean it was fined, it was filtered, they, you know, used some sulfur to make sure that there was no bacterial growth or that the wine is clean, so to speak. Each bottle will taste like each other bottle. I don't have to worry too much about bottle variation. There might be some oak usage on the wine. That's sort of a through line in the Wilson Daniels book. They're also always wines of quality that express something about the place that they come from. I can usually assume that they are good. I have yet to come across a Wilson Daniels product that is bad. So if you have a bottle of wine at home and it's not a domestic bottle, because you can't really do the importer thing with U.S. wine, look on the back. And then if you go out and find another bottle with that same importer, and you find that you like it, you may have keyed into an importer that aligns with your palate, and you can sort of use that as a touchstone going forward.
Which is a better indicator of palatal congruence? Is it producer or is it importer?
Palatal
which is a better indicator?
Congruence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I read the wine book you gave me.
That was a wonderful phrase you just used there.
Yeah.
It was confusing to no one. I would say I would lean towards the producer always, but the shopping by importer can be helpful because then you're just not buying the same producer over and over again.
Which is what I do.
Yeah, because people are afraid of spending their money on something that they're not going to like, which is very, very reasonable.
It's not even just the money, because we tend to stay fairly conservative in our choices. But like we talked about this on the pod before, our house white is a $13 bottle of Vouvray that you recommended to us, and we liked it. And so we just don't buy anything else. Like, we don't need to be adventurous. Like, it's not about the cost. It's about like, oh, well, shit, I've opened this up and now I don't like it. And what will I have with dinner? What will I deglaze this pan with?
Right. Not everyone has what I have, which is like, I've got a cellar full of wine. And if I open a bottle that I don't like, I can just go downstairs and pick a different bottle.
How much do you have in your cellar right now?
It's not huge, but it's probably somewhere in the like 150 bottle range, something.
That seems like a lot to me. And these are all unopened bottles. Are you aging some of them?
Yeah.
That feels like a lot.
It's not really a lot.
For a person, I guess. Not for a restaurant, but for a person. That feels like a lot to me.
Yes. Everyone out there who doesn't collect wine listening to this podcast will think that that is a lot. Anyone who does collect wine will say, damn, you need to buy more wine.
Collecting wine feels so strange to me. It feels like a more extreme version of like action figure dorks who won't take shit out of the package. But at least for them, if they take it, like you collect the thing, but then you never get to really experience it. But then with them, if they take it out of the package, at least they still have it. Whereas with wine collecting, once you take it out of the package, it is gone. Your collection is one smaller now. It'd be like if every time a comic book dork, which I am one, but I don't do the toys part, but if every time somebody opened up their mint in box 1967 Batman toy that, you know, they also had to throw it out. Or eat it. Collecting and consumption does not feel congruent to me. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Think about it this way. Each time you open a bottle of wine, you're opening it to mark an occasion. Be that like occasion very small, like a friend coming over for dinner, or very large, like a birthday, anniversary, whatever. And then you can remember when it was the last time you opened that great bottle of wine. And let's say I buy a case of Domaine La Roche, Grand Cru, something Chablis, and it's the 2016 vintage, and I open one in 2020, and then I open one in 2022, and then I open one in 2030. I've created
sort of... You're awfully optimistic, Jamie.
About my chances of survival? Yes.
About there being a 2030, but go on. I'm not worried about you specifically.
You should be. You would not do well without me. He's trying to come up right now with some way to hit me.
No, I'm given. I've been looking at the feedback. I've been looking at the spikes in listenership, and I've been looking at the social media buzz and our Reddit page that definitely exists. People love my very long, very radio friendly silent pauses where I stare at you contemptively. Contemptfully. I'm sorry.
Contemptuously.
Oh, contemptuously. That's
the word you were looking for.
Yeah, no, that is definitely the word I was looking for. I used to be much more articulate back when my only colleague wasn't 4 years old. Like, you know?
I know exactly.
I'm not as smart as I used to be. This is a great time for both of us to be engaging in something where we have to be articulate and well-spoken and verbose.
Maybe it'll force us to get better at that.
I feel like I'm getting a little better. I'm getting a little bit more conversant. But I still can't remember any proper nouns. Like, they're all just gone from my head. And some of the improper ones, too.
Maybe we should film something with you, like Dick Johnson is Dead, because you're obviously...
My mental decline is undeniable.
Where were we? Are we...
You were talking about producers and... I was asking you about collecting.
Yes, collecting wine is a different thing. The wine is ephemeral. Once you open it, it's gone. But you mark a time by the bottle of wine that you opened. I still think about, and I know that it's because I'm a wine guy and this kind of stuff is important to me, but like your bachelor party, the 1997 Clos du Val Cabernet that I brought for your, like, I still remember the way that wine tasted then, and sort of the feeling of that party is sort of wound up in that wine.
It's fascinating. I don't remember you being at my bachelor party, and I don't recall us having wine.
Motherfucker, I planned your bachelor party, and I did the wine pairings, and...
I know. No, but I'm leaning into, you know, the... Let's call it a bit about my mental decline. But no, like, I don't have that kind of recall. I remember you being very excited that there was a wine from the year that we met, and that being very sentimental and sweet. And I think it was a red wine, but I know that I drank it and thought it was good and then drank a lot of it and other things. But you have, like, this whole, like, sense memory experience of it that I just, like, I don't have at all.
Yeah. And I think about that when I think about opening different things from my cellar.
I guess something comparable is, like, I can probably remember what theater I saw. Not all, but many of the things that I've seen.
Yeah, and who you saw it with. Yeah, because we've had discussions where we talk about particular movies, and my recollections of the place and the people are a little bit more vague than yours are.
Yeah. And just sometimes straight up wrong, too.
But you didn't have to. There's no need for you to just attack.
No,
it's
important to me. You were a witness and a party to a substantial injury in my life that occurred in a movie theater parking lot after a screening, and you get all the details wrong every time. You just conveniently only remember the parts that don't in any way implicate you in me spraining my ankle.
I was not responsible in any way for any of the circumstances.
You were a party to it, though.
I was not. That is incorrect. We already established that proper nouns are fading out of your mind. Clearly, this memory also.
All right, well.
And you may have sustained a head injury at that time, so who knows?
I don't recall hitting my head.
Well, what percentage of people do?
We'll tell that tale another day.
Another day. But not enough people have seen widows. That's for goddamn sure.
That is extremely for goddamn sure. Oh, widows. Widows, you're just too good for this world. It's too good.
Talk to me a little bit about the, like, the release and what, maybe why people didn't see this? Was it a marketing thing or was it a...
It's a lot of things. Here's all the things working in the movie's favor. It comes out in 2018. It's from the Oscar-winning director, Steve McQueen, of 12 Years a Slave. It's from the writer of Gone Girl. It's a big, prestige studio heist movie. And it stars Academy Award winner Viola Davis, Academy Award nominee Liam Neeson, Academy Award winner Robert Duvall, Academy Award nominee Daniel Kaluuya, two-time Academy Award nominee Jackie Weaver, to say nothing of like a host of other extremely famous faces like Michelle Rodriguez and Colin Farrell. It premieres at Toronto International Film Festival to rave reviews. It comes out middle of November, right before Thanksgiving, which is a great slot for like an adult drama.
Why is November a good slot for an adult drama? Why is that a thing?
November is the lead up to, it's like the start of award season as far as things being released to the public.
I've never really understood what the, like, what inside what bounds, because it crosses the year line, right? Like the 20.
So for Oscar consideration, you need to have what's called a qualifying run. They've changed all the rules for 2020. It's totally fucked because of how weird theatrical releases were.
Right, so let's not talk about 2020.
But traditionally, like historically, the movie has to play in minimum of 4 screens in New York and LA for at least 2 weeks in the calendar year to be considered for that year's Oscars, which are not given out until either February or March of the following
year. Okay.
I read a thing from there was a box office analyst who basically said that the studio fucked up the marketing, that Fox, they heavily targeted black audiences, even though the film was, in the words of this box office analyst, quote, really not ethnically unidirectional, which is like an amazingly neutral way to talk about how racist marketing is. Like,
yeah, I think it connects broadly.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe the two of us are underestimating some of the like learned and inherent racism that people have that might have just turned people off.
Oh, well, that's certainly a huge part of it. Like as somebody who used to run movie theaters in the whitest neighborhoods in a predominantly black city, like when we would book a movie with a largely black cast, the white people did not come out.
Yeah.
We had Chirac, Spike Lee's modern retelling of Lysistrata, also set in Chicago. And we had huge audiences coming out, but like the white people just were not there to come see that movie, which is insane because it was great. So it came out in a crowded season. November is supposed to be a good time for adult dramas, but if there's a bunch of other shit that's also out that's way more high profile than your movie or with the studio who properly markets your movie, it got lost. Not that critics are an indication of success, but like that cast, the great reviews, 91% on the Tomatometer, and the movie...
Tomatometer. No one calls it that, right? That's just you?
I call it that. But it opens at number 5, 12 million domestic, wraps up its domestic run at $42.5 million. Basically, no one saw it. Linda Holmes, who writes for NPR and is the host of their Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, her review after Toronto, she said it felt to her like the kind of movie that would go on to make $300 million at the box office and win Best Picture and deserve all of it. And that is exactly how I feel as well. Like it felt like a big adult drama that could cross over. There's something for everybody. It's smart and it says something about the world without shoving it down your throat. It packages everything nicely and neatly in familiar, comfortable, exciting genre tropes and conventions. It has a knockout cast. The script is great. The action, which there's not a lot of, but like it's all thrilling. It gets you into it right away. It doesn't feel like a 2.5-hour movie. Like it just hustles along.
No.
In that opening sequence where we cut from the first shot of the movie, which is so striking and super sexy, which
and
is just
used to great effect for the rest of the film, too.
Yeah.
That like her against the sheets.
Oh, the contrast, right? Of like her dark skin tone, which is so beautifully lit the whole movie against those white sheets.
Yep.
It's Viola making out passionately with Liam Neeson in bed.
Viola Davis, yes.
Which is just startling for a number of reasons, like not least of which being like she's a middle-aged black woman, he's a upper middle-aged white man. Like there's also a lot of tongue in that first kiss. Like we're just still on the first shot.
We're about to bone kiss. Like yeah. that's yes, it's a passionate kiss, but it's specifically a like that's a foreplay kiss.
Yeah. But so it you go from that to
so that their kiss crescendos right as we begin to hear gunshots and extremities.
Right.
They cut from that to the heist. And dude, by the way, shooting out the back of that van to like get what you want in just the idea of doing that sounds stressful and difficult.
Yeah. So what Jamie's describing, if you're insane and haven't watched the movie at this point, is that whenever we're watching what ends up being a high-speed pursuit of Neeson and the gang, the whole chase is filmed from like a single camera position in the back of a generic white panel van, looking out the back doors while three of his guys are like holding on, shooting at cops, throwing random shit at them while the cops are pursuing them. And it never breaks. You never get a wide shot on an intersection. You never get close-ups on
the... No, it swings around to Liam Neeson in the driver's seat.
But it never cuts.
No.
We never break continuity of location. It's so subjective. Yep. Like, you get the entire car chase from the point of view of them fleeing. You can't tell where you're going because we're not looking at Neeson's point of view for most of it. In interviews, he and I think it was his DP, they talked about how for McQueen, coverage is the C word, which I think I've talked about before. Coverage is your traditional Hollywood way of shooting a scene, right? Close up on Jamie, close up on Scott. We get a two shot with both of us in the frame, and then we also get a really wide shot, and you can cut it up however you need to in the edit. And McQueen doesn't do that for a lot of scenes in this movie, especially the heisty scenes. He either does a clever one-er like that, or he finds an interesting place to put the camera and just holds it.
Speaking of clever wonders,
you're talking about the car.
After the press conference to Colin Farrell's house, so fucking good. It's so well placed because the script shines so incredibly bright right in that moment.
The camera is, I think it's mounted to the hood of the car. There's probably like a big rig on it to really secure the thing. The camera tracks exclusively outside the vehicle. And what's really in focus are the backgrounds. And we watch the very short drive from the neighborhood in the 18th Ward where he's going and making his press opportunity, where all we see are black faces and the buildings and like there's clearly a lot of public housing there. And then we drive with this fucking rant monologue from him all the way back to his very wealthy, like it's almost a gated community that he's living in. It's a great bit of visual storytelling. McQueen talked about it. He said that it came from this idea of needing to collaborate with the environment, that they wanted to visualize the real geography of Chicago, to visualize the idea of a gerrymandered district and a gerrymandered neighborhood, and to show just how fucking segregated the city is and just how cut off and isolated he is from the people he claims to want to be serving. There's so much happening in that scene. So much in that scene about the plot, about the subplots, about power
and
dynamics.
And also about the place. This is Chicago, right? The baseline, like the setting is pretty quintessentially American here. And it's a movie made by a Brit with some very specifically sort of Chicagoan sentiment. The same way that like when you enter Philadelphia, the people of Philadelphia have a particular feeling about the way our city is policed and the local politics here. And these big American cities have big American personalities. And maybe that is helpful to someone from outside to sort of paint a picture. But he paints a picture without it being a caricature at all.
Of America?
Of Chicago. It would be easy to make Chicago into a caricature.
I think they dabble in caricature a little bit, especially after the heist goes wrong and we're with the two detectives who are looking at like the smoldered ruins of the exploded van and they're trying to it. And the one cop is, what does he say? I always told Harry I'd hope he'd burn in hell. I guess Chicago will do. That's as close as it gets to like a silly like stereotype of Chicago. But like, I guess Chicago cops, that's okay.
That doesn't feel to me like a caricature. That feels to me like the way people who live in these cities feel about these cities.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge flex for McQueen on his, like, anyway, what I want to point out, every time, not every time, but many of the times that we meet Jatem, he's consuming something intellectual. He's listening to a podcast about Albert Woodfox, who is one of the Angola Three, who were held for the longest prison sentences or the longest solitary sentences in American history. This guy was in solitary confinement for 44 years before his case got thrown out. Jotem is listening to a podcast about this guy. He's reading a book. Later on, he's listening to some other podcast, I think.
Well, he's listening to the debate at the end of the movie.
The debate, that's right. I think that's a very interesting part of who Jotem is. Not that he's intellectual. He's in politics right now. Obviously, he's a smart guy. I think it's interesting that he pairs learning, or that he's like so experience that killing and hurting people that he can be, yes, he can be yes. learning something right before doing that.
Well, it's not just learning though, because in the scene where he and the crew show up at Bash's house, Bash played by the amazing Garrett Dillahunt, one of like a half dozen people in this movie who the movie's only sin is that they don't use Garrett Dillahunt and Carrie Coon and a couple other people's more than they actually do. But they show up at Bash's house, and while the guys are beating the shit out of Bash, they turn on the game and he cranks the volume up, and it's not just a practical thing to like make sure the neighbors don't hear the horrible violence happening. He's super into it.
Yeah.
He can switch off so easily. It's something McQueen talked about, that with the shooting of the scene where he executes the two failed guards while he's making them rap for him. But so it plays out in this roving Steadicam-like medium shot where he gets right up in their faces while they're rapping, and it just, the camera slowly circles the two of them and him. And he's maintaining this like fierce, threatening eye contact with them. And then the circle only finally stops after he fires the last shot. And McQueen said that he doesn't shot list for the most part, that he has to find things in the moment, but that for that shot, it was all about the character told him the way to film it, and that the character repeatedly in the script is somebody who is, like, he's someone who has a life of violence, right? He has a lot of experience with violence, and he's gotten bored, so he's finding ways to make violence interesting to him again.
And then he does them each differently, too. He shoots the one while he's rapping and then tells the other to run, probably because he wants to see if he can get him in one shot at that range.
He just wants to be entertained.
Okay, so I would like to take a moment.
Yes, what do you want to discuss about this movie?
I want to talk about Linda and Alice.
Linda and Alice rule. Where do you stand on Michelle Rodriguez? Because not everybody is a fan of Michelle, and I think she's terrific.
I'm always happy to see Michelle Rodriguez pop up.
What have you seen her in? Because you weren't a lost person. You've seen some of the Fast movies, maybe?
I saw the first one. Honestly, I don't have a huge number of specific memories of her. Like, the most specific one is, like, Avatar, which I love. I love her in Avatar.
She's perfect in that. It's not a great movie and it's not a great part, but she is the perfect person to play that role, and she elevates it, and she's wonderful.
It's a good role to talk about when we're talking about Linda.
Yeah.
Because Linda is as far from whatever her generic soldier name in Avatar was.
It was Gunny Tough Chick. That's what her name was.
She's done a number of roles like that. Am I right? This is not the...
Yeah, well, she's like an action person. Like, her breakout role was she plays a boxer in this movie called Girl Fight from mid to late 90s, which was like a huge breakout for her, and she's great in it. And then she's been in many, but not all, of the Fast and Furious movies. Jamie, this will be a great hook to get you to watch the Fast movies. She dies in Fast and Furious 4 and comes back in number 6 with amnesia.
Oh, man. Oh, I totally forgot she's also in SWAT as Badass Tough Chick as well.
Yeah, I think everyone who saw SWAT forgot that movie.
I remember it only because that was at the height of our stupid...
That was bad.
We want to go see bad movies to heckle them phase.
The summer of 2003, after a few minor disappointments, precocious 18-year-old Jamie and Scott decide that, well, Ang Lee's Hulk was bad, which, looking back on it, I was a Philistine and a Cretan.
Was a Philistine and
a Cretan. Because of a few movies were mildly disappointing, we will only go see the bad things. I think that peaked with SWAT, where, like, SWAT was too mediocre of a target for us to make fun of that much, and there was way too big of an audience on opening night.
Yeah.
Didn't somebody throw popcorn at us? Not at you or me.
We went with TJM got hit with popcorn. TJM got hit with popcorn. I think Oakley did too. Oakley almost started a fight that night. Yeah.
That was a good one. Oh, SWAT.
We were really smart people back then, weren't we? Anyway.
But yeah, I my favorite Linda scene, I mean, it's her big scene, right? She's trying to figure out where these blueprints in Harry's notebook came from. And she gets the name of the architect who designed it, goes to that person's house, ends up speaking to the architect's husband. And very quickly, the shell game of her pretending that she's, you know, an architecture person trying to learn something falls apart when he's like, you're obviously not from the firm because my wife died 4 months ago. So I've seen the movie 4 times and I have a little bit of a different read on that scene almost every time because she freezes. And at first you think like, oh shit, like she realizes that the jig is up. And then as it plays on, like, oh no, this has just triggered her trauma. Yeah. She's triggered. She's thinking about her husband. She's feeling enormous guilt for like unintentionally upsetting and triggering this guy. And then the two of them fall into this
crying,
sobbing, grieving embrace that is so beautiful and heartbreaking. I almost thought it was a play. Like she, because I'm so used to like, In a heist movie for that to be.
That would have been the thing.
Like she's trying to think through what the next step is. But no, she's just a little bit broken and she can't handle it.
And she apologizes and runs out. And then he sits there also broken. And it ends like what could be a scene about infiltration and information gathering ends up being a scene about two grieving people who are alone in the world.
The movie does that a bunch of times where it just slows down. It doesn't have to barrel along with the plot and the setup for the heist. It gives you all these moments where you think about the emotional reality of what these characters are going on and like how it is they have to navigate this hostile fucking world that they're living in.
So
the other casting thing is the role of Alice was originally offered to Jennifer Lawrence, which I almost can't imagine.
I cannot imagine that.
But J-Law turned it down, and then they actually auditioned DeBicki, who is, or DeBicki?
DeBicki.
She's blown up in the last couple of years, and she's like the most exciting thing in most things that she shows up in. She's in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. as like the villain, and that movie did not make much of an impression with me, but she's outstanding in it. She's in the Baz Luhrmann, Great Gatsby. She plays Jordan. She's terrific in that. The only thing I actually liked about that movie. She's in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. She plays the head of the gold people, the like up their own asses, gold aliens. And she's awesome in it. And yeah, I just want to see her show up in everything ever again. And she should always be allowed to be tall because it looks silly when fucking Kenneth Branagh is wearing lifts to try and look as tall as I think she's 6'5".
She's 6'4"?
According to IMDb, she is 6'2¾".
Okay. Well, either way, she is an incredible actor. Her performance in this is unbelievable. Like, her performance informs the character, but I'm so compelled by the character of Alice. And her relationship with Linda. Like, they become bonded.
Well, they bond because they're exploited by Veronica.
Right.
They feel leveraged and exploited by her in the same way that they probably felt by their shitty husband.
So they come together. That's maybe the most outlandish part of this movie, is someone emotionally growing as quickly as Alice does. From someone who's battered and trauma bonded to someone who is self-possessed and self-determining and self-sufficient. Obviously, I think that they're both very compelling characters, and I think that they were the ones whose experiences were the most interesting to me because they seem like they come from a reality that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of a guy who's in politics and also into heists who lives in penthouse suites and has his son drives a Mercedes and whatever. Like
yeah.
That's not an experience that I have. I'm also nowhere near any kind of gang violence, so that those experiences are foreign to me. But the idea of women being taken advantage of by partners in like good faith relationships, that it's a thing that I've seen in my lifetime. I think that these two women come out of it in completely different ways as self-sufficient people. And it's really interesting to watch Linda completely unravel over the first part of the movie and Alice to unravel very briefly, only to piece herself together very, very quickly.
Yeah.
They both come in the end to the same place of being their own person outside of these abusive relationships, but they take completely divergent paths together.
They both also have like really gratifying small payoff grace notes. Really, really simple things that's just like good screenwriting that sometimes feels like screenwriting, but like in a movie like this where it's so dense, like it's just a little note that can really do it. Like Linda, when they go to the shooting range, doesn't hit the fucking target at all. come the end of the movie, she's the one who pulls off the perfect shot and takes down Robert Duvall. Linda, when they're training, is the one that Veronica makes put on like a double weight bag of money. And she's like, why the fuck did you make me do that? So you'd be prepared. So we could try for every best and worst case scenario. Well, Alice gets shot. Alice can't carry her bag of money anymore. Linda is the one who carries the two bags out to the car. Just little tiny things that like punctuate stuff that had been set up earlier that all really pays off in gratifying and not showy ways at all. Ooh, I have two more things I wanted to say. They're both brief notes and they're both...
You know what's fun? When both of us say the word brief, it never means that.
That is true.
We fundamentally, like, we know what brevity is and we want it, but we never get it.
Yeah.
Okay, what are your brief notes?
So the first is I'm sharing you my screen so you can see this picture here. Can you, Jamie, identify this spirit? You're seeing what I'm seeing right now?
Yeah, I meant to, you sent this to me and I was...
This is what Veronica is drinking when one of the Mannings calls her to threaten her. I forget which scene it was. So they call her to say, you've got 2 weeks, and then they hang up. It does not look like wine. It's a white label. The text is all very large, and I can make out the words local and rye on it, but the liquid inside appears to be clear.
Yeah, I would guess that it's vodka.
But it says rye.
Yeah, vodka. What do you believe that vodka can be made of?
Potatoes and...
That's one thing.
Wheat?
It's most commonly made from just like kind of any kind of grain. It can be barley, it can be wheat, it can be rye. Philadelphia Distilling Company makes a vodka called Penn 1681 that is predominantly rye.
Oh.
It's a grain neutral spirit, which just means that it's been distilled enough times that it tastes and smells like nothing, which is why I think that vodka drinkers are boring, because vodka is boring. And if you drink vodka, you're boring.
Well, all right then.
And that's my hot take for today.
So there is that one. And then the other image, and I think I texted this to you last night. So when you said textured, this shot is one of like the first things that I thought of. This incredible close-up on Viola Davis's eye when I think this is when she's laying in bed just after she's realized that Harry is back.
Yeah, and for the listenership, this is a very striking image from the film where, as Scott said, it's a close-up on Viola Davis's eye. Exactly half of her eye is in shadow, the other half is in light, and the light is sort of cascading from the bridge of her nose across her face to reveal the texture of her skin, pores and everything, and then the other half is sort of obscured by darkness. It's a gorgeous composition.
It's stunning, and so much of this movie, and this is in all of McQueen's films, there's texture. Like, you watch a Steve McQueen movie, and it looks like you can reach out and touch everything that you're seeing. It even comes down to sound design. We talked about how we keep coming back to Veronica in bed, putting her hand on Harry's pillow, right? That sense of emptiness, that sense of Harry haunting and lingering in the movie. And that's texture, but it's visual, but it's also sound. You get the contrast of her really rich, dark skin tones against that white, crisp linen. But then the sound design puts in the really tiny, imperceptible sound of her hand brushing across the pillowcase. That's texture too. Like, it's all about putting you in the place.
Yes, I think that this movie uses visual texture in a way that I struggle to explain what I mean by texture to people in wine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I haven't attempted to describe visual texture to people, but I would imagine that you have some difficulty communicating that as well. And it's more abstract in movies than it is in wine. Because in wine...
Right,
like,
there's actually texture.
My fallback explanation has just been, like, literally how the wine feels in your mouth. And it's different... Like, it's easy to think before you, like, intellectually snap in and start, you know, experiencing a little bit more of what's going on, that all wine just sort of has a wet wine texture.
Yeah. It's not dry, it's wet.
Some are a little abrasive, some are, I'm just ignoring you.
That's fair.
Some are a little astringent, some have a higher acidity, which makes your mouth water, some are fuller bodied, which sort of fill your mouth up more than something that might just run straight down your palate. That's what texture is in wine. In film, it's something totally, it's a little bit ephemeral, not ephemeral, a little bit abstract.
It can be, like, I would use texture to describe a couple of things. So like in this movie, when you talk about texture, what I was really thinking about is the texture of the mise-en-scene. You get a sense of the texture of her clothing, like her wardrobe is such a big part of the movie. When you go into the warehouse for the first time, like it's grungy, you almost can imagine like she's putting her hands on surfaces. A lot of texture is about like letting the characters experience a texture just by touching something so that the audience can experience it as well. But the other way that texture can be represented is in the image. If you're shooting on film, grain is a huge thing that gives you texture. The grain itself is like in the photochemical process of the film, depending on what type of film stock you select, the grain can be larger or smaller. Like a really fine film grain can show a lot of details, and a really coarse film grain can obscure details, but it makes your image toothsome almost. Right? Like you can touch the image and it applies a texture toothsome. To everything in it. Toothsome.
It is toothsome.
But then you can also give texture with color. So in the 35 millimeter days, it was called color timing. And it was this process of what chemicals you soak the film stock in after it's been shot. And how does that bring out different colors or different levels of light and dark? Now we call it color grading. It's happening entirely digitally. Jamie, you're a big Instagram slut. Whenever you're using an Instagram filter.
Wow. That was your. It's an offensive word that you just used there.
Instagram?
It's not. I'm not offended. I.
but so whenever you apply an Instagram filter, you are doing like a very basic version of color grading. Like a super simplified way to explain it is that you are applying one color value to highlights, maybe a different color value to midtones, and then a separate color value to shadows. And the contrast or the complementary nature of how those colors fit together can give depth and dimension and more texture to an image. They're doing like most of this in camera, like they're not leaning on a digital color grade to get that color look. Like they're using colored lights and colored gels to highlight and accentuate different parts of the rooms. Like go back and watch the movie again and just watch any of the scenes in the warehouse and look at all of the different colors that are present on the walls in that room.
I hadn't thought about that.
There's greens, there's blues, there's yellows. There's shit that, like, unless Harry and the boys are having fucking parties where they've got, like, uplights all over the place, you would never have a room that looks that way. It's something that Guillermo del Toro does a lot, too. It's not like Wes Anderson, right? Like, Wes Anderson, if he wants a blue wall, the wall is blue. Instead, these guys make a naturalistic-looking wall, and then you color it and light it expressively, which gives you depth, it gives you contrast, it makes your characters pop out more, but it also is a way to accentuate the texture. Because if the wall behind my character is a much starker and different color than the character in the foreground, it's going to highlight the details and the rivets right. And the actual texture of the set dressing.
So have we arrived at the part of the episode where we decide whether this wine pairs well or not?
I think we have. I think we both agree textured. I think the wine is textured. I think it's there's layers.
I think drinking this wine while talking about this movie feels like an appropriate pairing. I think you picked exactly the right movie. It's fun because like the wine itself matches up in a number of ways. Like it's I told you that it was steely, by which I mean it has elevated acidity and a lot of mineral tones that give it sort of a hard edge.
I think you just described Viola Davis's character. In this movie. This is like one of those moments when this whole concept is actually gelling. Like you said steely, yeah. And I thought about Veronica Rawlings. And you said rich, and I thought about the complex tapestry that this movie weaves and how rewarding it is. And you said texture, and I thought about skin, and I thought about sheets and wardrobe and the feel of Chicago. Like, yeah, girl.
You touched on it a little bit earlier when you said that this movie is sort of so broadly appealing, but it comes from sort of a more intellectual high place. You know, Steve McQueen is capable of really, really specific and intentional commentary. And while this movie gives it, it also is extremely enjoyable for basically everyone.
Yeah, just like this wine.
And I think that this wine comes from a producer that is like that also and is sort of in that way. You know, this producer is famous for the Grand Cru wines that it produces that age forever, that it applies an awful lot of winemaking to, by which I mean like a bunch of oak and sort of intentional racking and figuring out, you know, where the wine is going and then releasing it at the proper time. But then they also make a bunch of just base Bourgogne Chardonnay that is made thoughtfully, but also made to be enjoyed immediately. They put it under a screw cap, which means that fewer bottles will be flawed. What you get is a wine that hints at a lot of larger themes in wine, like limestone soils and cool climate and south-facing slopes, while still just delivering an experience that's fun and sort of without season. Like, this wine is for winter. It's also for spring, summer, fall.
But not... Wait, hang on. That's all four. You got
That's
it.
All
you got all the seasons.
You're doing good at counting, buddy. You're doing great.
I'm hanging in there.
Yeah, not to tap ourselves on the back too much, but like, yeah, I think we nailed it. We fucking slammed.
Yeah, I think it's a super successful pairing.
Also, I just love Chardonnay, and the opportunity to drink like great Chardonnay and discuss a great movie. For me personally, this is hog heaven. We've got all the things that make me happy.
All the things?
Maybe not all the things, but like a number of the things. We don't have food, and I do like food.
I am a big fan of food. That feels like a pretty great place to wrap up the main body segment of this here episode today.
All right. This has been, I think, a killer episode. I'm happy to have watched this movie and drunk this wine.
I agree. I'm happy to have drunk this wine. It's extremely tasty, and I'm always happy to watch Widows again.
All right, kids. Love y'all. Be safe. Wear a mask. Wash your hands. Don't be a dick.
Love you, buddy. I'll talk to you later.
All right. I'm hitting stop on this recording.
Goodbye, internet people.
Yep. Hey, it's Jamie again.
And it's Scott again.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. We're back to tell you about next week's pairing. Scotty Too Hottie, what's the flick?
So we watched Bong Joon-ho's 2019 fucking all-time great masterpiece, Parasite. This is the movie that was an international sensation. It's the highest grossing movie of all time in his native South Korea. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and it won Best Picture at the Oscars, and it's just the best movie. It's currently available on Hulu. If you're like Jamie and haven't seen it yet, watch Parasite, because it's the best.
So... Scott gave me quite the description for the pairing on this wine. He told me that this movie was precise, genre fluid, tonal balance, upstairs, downstairs, geographically specific, and global in appeal.
Yes, all of that is accurate.
Which is A, a whole mouthful, and B, I don't even know where to go with a pairing. So I went where I usually go when I don't know where to go, which is bubbles. We're going to be drinking Fabrice Gasnier's La Craventine. This is a sparkling rosé from Cabernet Franc coming from the Loire Valley. It is precise, for sure. I would call all sparkling wine genre fluid, as it goes with such a wide variety of things. And
it's all champagne as well.
I'll actually murder you, like with my hands.
Okay, that's fine.
Just so that we're very, very clear. Anyway, the wine's killer. It's been on lists that I've run for easily a decade, and I love it every time I drink it. I'm excited to drink it watching this flick.
Don't call Parasite a flick.
Aren't they all
Aquaman
flicks?
Is a flick. No. Oh, all right. This is your champagne revenge. Okay, I get it.
You call them all. It's you go and you watch a flick.
Right. You just casually put it on while you're surfing your phone and making duck lips for Instagram. Well, so that's next week. Bong Joon-ho's Parasite on the Hulu. Jamie, what is that champagne again?
It's not champagne. It's Fabrice Gasnier's La Craventine.
All right. And Jamie, where can they get that?
Y'all can pick it up at Moore Brothers Wine Company. They have outlets in Wilmington, Delaware, in Pennsauken, New Jersey, and in Manhattan, New York. They also ship pretty widely. The next seven wines for this podcast also came from Moore Brothers Wine Company. So check out our socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. That's on Twitter, Facebook, and the Instagram for a full list of the next seven upcoming. I'd get yourself a little mixed case Got some room in there for you to get some extra if you'd like, and I think you should, because the selection at Moore Brothers is spectacular. Holler at me if you need further recommendations.
But at the very least, get yourself that Fabrice Gasnier. And like Jamie said, we have the pairing, so it's the next 7 movies, including Parasite, and the next 7 wines to go with them. And you guys can play along with us. We're going to be sticking with a bi-weekly schedule for right now, so make sure wherever you listen to podcasts to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you can, hop on the old Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review. We'll be reading all reviews, including the bad ones, on upcoming episodes.
Not if you can. We demand tribute in the form of reviews and subscriptions.
But they have to make an Apple Podcast account.
Yeah, it's a just stupid do thing. It.
You have to have an iTunes account.
I don't care how inconvenient it is. Just do it.
All right. Well, that's fair. Fine. Jamie's right. Just do it. Make an account. Give us a review there. But subscribe wherever you listen. Subscribe on multiple platforms if you want. Those numbers are meaningful to me. I love my metrics. Give me those analytics.
It's always a pleasure to podcast with you, Scotty Tuhati. We will see all of you next time to talk about Parasite and some bubbly Cabernet Franc.
We will not see any of you next time because this is a one-way audio medium, but
metaphorically, we will metaphorically see them.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll hear you back here in 2 weeks for Parasite and some sparkling rosé champagne.
God damn it.
All right. Good night, everybody. Goodbye and good luck.